Good morning. Good Monday morning to you, and welcome to Jump in Tucson. I am Dr. Ed Ackerley, and on Monday, our theme is Wonder, where we celebrate the good things going on at the University of Arizona, including student projects and learning and student outcomes, as well as top-level performances and top-tier research going on with faculty and scientists at the U of A. We also like to highlight people who do really interesting and cool things in lots of different areas, and there's a lot going on at the University of Arizona over the last 100 years or more. Great things going on. So our guest this morning is Gregory McNamee. He is an alumnus of the University of Arizona. You graduated around the time I did in 78 and 80. You have a couple degrees from the U of A. So welcome to Jump in Tucson, Greg.
Thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here.
So you're the author of 40 books or so, and they, you know, your bio says over 10,000 periodical pieces. That is a lot of writing you've done over the last several years.
It's all I know how to do. I don't know how to do anything useful, so that's how I spend my days.
You are a prolific writer. You even do some contributing work to Encyclopedia Britannica. So you have lot of fingers out there of lots of different things, and have really, really been prolific, if you will.
Well, thank you. That's kind of you to say. It's as I say, that's I get up in the morning and I get to my desk and I work, and 40 years goes by, and pretty soon there's a stack of stuff,
So that's really cool. Well, let's talk a little bit about your young life and how you got interested in writing and the humanities, and just being the author that you are. How did that all come about? How did you kind of discover that was kind of the direction you would be heading?
I think I learned very early on that I was interested in storytelling. I was interested in books and reading. My father was a career army officer, and so we traveled all over the world. And when you do that, you don't have an opportunity to form deep attachments with people so much as with, the stories you know about people. You don't have a lot of time to live with them, but right. You do have time to hear them out. And so so I just became interested in writing, and that has carried over all my life.
And so You went to the University of Arizona. Did you take off and go away and then come back to Tucson, or how are you connected to Tucson since you graduated from the U of A?
Well, I graduated in 1980 with a degree in English, and then wandered down to Mexico, and I taught down there for about half a year, and decided that I was. That wasn't quite for me, so I came back up to Tucson, and I interviewed. I had a couple of friends in graduate school who were working for IBM as tech writers, and they said, come and we'll get you an interview. And at the same time, I interviewed at the U of A for a proofreading job at the University of Arizona Press. The full-time job at IBM paid about eight times more than the half-time job at the U of A did, and naturally I took the U of A job.
Right, there you go.
That put me in the U of A Press, the right. publisher of this book. From there I worked for 9 years as rose to the rank of editor-in-chief there, and then decided in about 1990 that I wanted to see if I could live without adult supervision and see if I could get myself to my desk in the morning, and so it has been ever since.
That's great. Well, you've written this really phenomenal book. It's called The University of Arizona: A History in 100 Stories, and it's a celebration of what you've just been talking about, storytelling about people, ideas, inventions, teaching, and the things that have been part of the school's history. This little land-grant university that has grown into this huge Research One institution. Curious, fascinating approach, by the way. I just think it's really a unique and creative approach to tell the history of the U of A. But how did you come up with the concept to tell the history and this storytelling of 100 different stories?
Well, the university press approached me and asked me if I would be interested in writing a history of the university, and I think they had envisioned at first a kind of a narrative chronological from 1885 to the present history. And I thought that just didn't sound very exciting to me. It didn't sound exciting as a reader or as a writer. And there have been any number of books. Joe Poznanski, who comes to the book festival every year, for example, has written a couple of books, 100 Reasons Why We Love Football and 100 Reasons Why We Love Baseball. There have been, 100 great moments in world history, 100. It just seemed a natural number to pull out. And so I suggested, instead of that narrative history, that we could cover all the bases, but do it with a much lighter touch with these little stories. And these 100 stories, very few of them exceed 1,000 words. And most of them run about 750 words. So you can sit down over a bowl of cereal and read a story in the morning kind of thing without stretching too hard, I think. To my mind, it worked out very nicely. It was fun to write, and so I hope it will be fun to read.
And it's also one of those kind of books, like you say, that you can set it down and pick it back up, set it down, pick it back up, and kind of still stay kind of light with it, because it's each an individual little story as you're reading so long. So it's not like you're reading it necessarily in a timeline that you have to sit down and read it all at one time. So it's kind of a neat approach to it.
Yeah, well, thank you. I appreciate that. And as I say, it was fun to do it that way, fun to think of it. It was hard to narrow it down just to 100 when I got thinking about it.
Right. Now that you've written this 100 years and 100 stories about the U of A, the history over the 140 years, what makes the University of Arizona special for you as you sit back and look at this this book? What makes the U of A special for you?
Well, I've got half a century of connection with the place, and so I see lots of different ways in which it's special, and I suppose any alumnus of any university might feel the same way, but we have, for a start, one of the most beautiful campuses on the country. Architecturally, it's a fantastic place. It never fails to surprise me when I'm on campus just how beautiful it is. And we have a couple of odd buildings that I tell stories about. The mathematics building, for example, in the shape of a mathematical variable X or a multiplication sign.
Right.
Which, by the way, didn't have a woman's restroom for the first couple of decades that it was open, because why would women be studying math, right?
when we come back after the break, we'll delve a little bit more into the 100 stories that tell the history of the wonderful things going on at the University of Arizona over the last 140 years since 1885. Our guest is Gregory McNamee, who is an author and a person who wrote the book from UA Press. You're listening to Jump in Tucson. We'll be back after the break to talk a little bit more about the history of the University of Arizona. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is the Monday edition of Wonder at the University of Arizona, where we talk about the good things going on at the University of Arizona. With us this morning is author Gregory McNamee, who is an alumnus of the U of A in the late 70s, early 80s, but also spent many years with the U of A Press, and now has written a book, which is a great book. It's called The University of Arizona, A History in 100 Stories, and it's 100 stories about what has happened over the U of A in the last 140 years. So, Greg, when you talk about the history and so forth, and the history that you share in the book, how has that history of those individual stories shaped the institution, the U of A itself, but also Tucson in the Southwest? We talk often about how important the U of A is to the lifeblood of Tucson in and of itself. How has this history that you wrote down kind of helped shape that history of Tucson in Southern Arizona?
That's a great question, Ed. I appreciate that. I was thinking about just that very thing this morning, and thinking about how success builds on success. And the university has been a steady stream of incremental successes for a very long time, and then some very rapid ones, depending on who was in charge of things. Right. But I was thinking, for example, the history of the Wildcats basketball, and of course, for the last 30-odd years, we have watched the Wildcats excel in basketball. Thinking back on that, though, right after the end of World War II, both Mo and Stu Udall very important to the political history of Arizona, were lead players on the U of A Wildcats. Great basketball players. And Mo, in fact, went off and played professionally for the Denver Nuggets for a year after graduating from school. So there's a long tradition in almost everything we look at there. And of course, that reverberates out into the world, simply in the political world. Almost every political person of consequence in Arizona today has some connection to the U of A.
Right.
As for those who have connections with ASU, we'll forget about them.
Right, exactly.
there is that. So there hasn't been much in the way of that town and gown tension that we see so often elsewhere. You know, the university is well beloved in the community, and I think has done, for the most part, good things in the community.
Right, right. Overall, a really good thing for the. So, can you share a couple of stories that come to mind that readers might find really interesting in the book? These 100 stories about the history of the University of Arizona. A couple that come to mind that you might want to share.
Well, one of them that stands out to me is the fact that for many years on our campus, we had something that very few people knew about, and that was our own nuclear reactor.
Wow.
Tucked away in a little building right next to the student union.
Great.
And strangely enough, I happened to be taking an ancient Greek course in that building and was sitting out in the courtyard of the building, looked down through the kind of the frosted glass and saw something odd and wandered down into the basement. And there it was. The U of A had its own little department of nuclear engineering, and it was training future nuclear engineers. And of course, that was in the late 70s. We had a couple of nuclear mishaps that put nuclear engineering in grave doubt, and so the reactor was decommissioned 20 years ago. But it took years to get it decommissioned. It took years to disassemble the thing and get it out of there safely. So that's one. Kind of connected to that in an odd way is when I don't know how you were as an undergraduate, but I was fascinated by stories of tunnels. You know, there were supposed to be tunnels that led everywhere, like the catacombs of Rome, under campus. And so I went down there a couple of times. I did ask the U of A Police Department if there's a statute of limitations on that, if you can get in trouble for that. Never did get a reply.
Right.
But whatever the case, there is, in fact, an interesting network of tunnels that runs through mostly the old campus, and mostly they're utility tunnels. But, you know, back in the days of Dungeons and Dragons, students used to go and disappear in there for, you know, try to emerge in the library or in the student union or someplace from the dorm that they started off in.
Right.
So I tell the story of the tunnels and stories of ghosts and stories of great professors and great athletes. You know, the stories go on.
Right. There's a lot of neat things, you know, even though just the history itself of Old Main, that's where the president's office is now, but the history of that building itself kind of shapes the U of A and is kind of iconic for that. And even around where you're talking about those nuclear reactor was, those trees that are around there, you know, you can take if you're an arborist, you can go around some of those buildings and there's a little, like a ecology of trees that you get to see, and that's kind of neat. It's kind of interesting little tidbits like that that happen on the U of A campus, which are really kind of neat little stories to hear about.
Well, absolutely. So thank you so much. In fact, you know, one of the first buildings that was put up after Old Main was a greenhouse, that being a land-grant institute, the University of Arizona started off with a very strong agricultural dimension that it retains today. Very important research being done in agriculture at the U of A for the problem of feeding the future world. And I think it's wonderful that we have that kind of continuity of connection from 1885 to the present with an interest in growing things.
That's great. So we're talking with Greg McNamee, who is an author and retired from the U of A and an alumnus of the U of A, who wrote this wonderful book called The University of Arizona, A History in 100 Stories. If someone wanted to get a hold of the book, what was the best place? U of A Press, but how would they, obviously it's available probably a lot of places, but where do they go to get the copy of the book?
In town, I think you could probably find it at Barnes & Noble and certainly the university campus store, mm-hmm. If you venture onto campus. Online, you can order it through the University of Arizona Press or through Barnes & Noble or through Amazon. As they say, wherever you like to buy your books, it should be around.
That's great. So, you know, this is a great project and you've done a great job on this. I'm excited to delve into some more of the stories that you've related here. I'm kind of a U of A junkie, as you can tell. So I kind of know a little bit about a lot of things on campus just because I've lived here all of my life and the U of A has been so important to me, teaching there now for almost 35 years as well. What are you working on next? What's your next project in this? Obviously, you're promoting your book now, and you'll be doing that for a while. But you got something else on the horizon that you're working on?
Oh, I have probably 40 books that I would like to live long enough to write.
know that story, yeah.
Yeah, most immediately, I have a book that I'm editing for the Smithsonian on supermassive black holes.
Oh, wow.
Which the University of Arizona, of course, has led in astronomy and in the study of black holes. And the very first photographs of black holes came from us. So just finishing up, I'm doing another big project for the Encyclopedia Britannica on world history. And once I get those cleared, if I'm still living and breathing when all of that stuff is done, then I have a few other books of my own that I think I might like to start in on, but I'll surprise you with those.
Right. So, what's been the reaction since the book has come out in the history of the University of Arizona? What's the reaction been from people who have read it and have engaged with you and talked with you about it in your presentations about this book? It's pretty cool, isn't it?
Well, I so far it's been good. I haven't had any hate mail yet, right. but who knows? You know, you never can't write any of those possibilities off. The book is so new that I haven't had a chance really to gauge a whole lot of reaction, except of course people who have read it, sort of the faculty advisors that I drew on, and this mm-hmm. and that. The U of A Press itself. People seem to like the book, and I hope they will continue to like it. Aim to make it as various as possible so that there would be something in it for everybody.
What a great holiday gift idea to someone who's a U of A fan or U of A aficionado like me. What a great little gift to have at the holidays is to get the history of the university, because it's so easy to read and presents such a unique perspective on all the 100 stories that are there. Tell us a little about U of A Press, and that this is pretty prestigious to have your book come out of the place that you were contributing for so many years. It's kind of nice they've changed over the years, but they're still a formidable force in the publishing business, right?
They certainly are. I think one of the great regional presses in the country. I went to work for the press when it was just about 20 years old. You know, it was founded in 1959 by the action of former President Richard Harville, one of the great presidents of the university, mm-hmm. really one of the great builders of the present university. And since then, in the time that I worked there, we published several hundred books, many of which are still alive all these years later. I've been gone from daily work there for nearly 35 years now. Mm-hmm. So there are a lot of things that, you know, I go back and people who are much younger than I am, who sort of look at me with you know, wow, there's Methuselah coming down the road with stories of how the Bible was written.
right. Well, congratulations.
But, it is a great place.
Congratulations on your book, The University of Arizona, History in 100 Stories. Author is Greg McNamee, who is just a delight to have, and it's great to have those 100 stories of the University of Arizona. Appreciate you joining us on Jump in Tucson. So thanks for being with us this morning.
Thank you so much. Pleasure to be here.
You're listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI, 1030 AM, The Voice, Tucson's only live local news and talk station. We'll be back after the break with some more good things about the University of Arizona on Jump in Tucson. Welcome back to Jump in Tucson. This is Dr. Ed Ackerley, your host. This is the Monday Wonder Show at the University of Arizona, all talking about the really neat and cool things that happen at the University of Arizona. And one of those is I would call a world-renowned astronomer who came and actually did a presentation for one of my classes about a decade ago. Amazing. The students were just floored by his vision and talking about the stars. Welcome to Jump in Tucson, Dr. Chris Impey. Welcome.
Yeah, it's great to be with you, Ed.
Really appreciate it. You're a University Distinguished Professor of Astronomy in the College of Science, and we had the good fortune of listening to you the other day. You were part of the TEDx Arizona homecoming event, which was the Desert Oasis, and you were one of the featured speakers at that TEDx event, and you talked about our future off Earth. So we're going to talk about that in just a little bit. Let's talk first, though, about how you got to become interested in space and how that, in your young life, how you've turned it into a career of looking at the stars.
Sure. Well, I mean, astronomers are sort of branded two different ways. Sometimes they're kids with little telescopes who just keep trading up to bigger and bigger telescopes. But I sort of grew up in big cities, London, New York. You know, we didn't have stars or a sky. And the other way, most professional astronomers train in physics. Physics is sort of the gateway drug, if you like, to astronomy, because everything in astrophysics and understanding how the universe works is based on physics. So I studied physics as an undergrad, then astronomy, and then I was living in the cloudy, rainy British Isles, so realized I needed to come where the skies were dark and clear, and so I came to a place where we make big telescopes and great instruments in Arizona, and I've been here a long time.
Yeah, when did you get to the U of A? How long have you been at the College of Science in the astronomy department?
Yeah, it was, I left the UK, I got a PhD in Edinburgh, went did some postdocing in Caltech and Hawaii, actually, also a lot of good telescopes, and then came here in 1986. Mm-hmm. So I've been on the faculty for however long that is, coming on 40 years.
Great. So you presented again during the Desert Oasis TEDx event a couple of weeks ago, and the title was Our Future Off Earth. And so with, as you said, the leaps and bounds of Blue Origin and SpaceX and these private companies that are working with NASA and the European Space Agency, there's a possibility of ordinary people traveling beyond Earth's atmosphere. And so how will humans make that leap from Earth and being grounded here on Earth to traveling in space? How will we accept that reality in the future?
I mean, for it to happen for more than a handful of people and for a handful of very rich people, the costs will have to come down. And that's what these private space companies are doing. They're taking a model where we used to, you know, with Apollo or even the space shuttle, you'd throw away most parts of the rocket. And they were very expensive, these launches. And the reusable rockets are changing everything. So the cost per kilo into Earth orbit, if you like, is dropped by 10 or 20 times in a decade. That's dramatic. That's not enough to bring it within the realm of every people, everyday people. But it's heading in that direction. So that's a game changer. And that's all in the last 10 years, basically.
So space travel has high risk in it, just inherently, just because you're blasting off in with a propellant underneath you. How will the space industry embrace this evolution of technology of sending, common citizens out into the space?
I think they're hoping for the evolution that was followed by commercial aviation. So, we make a parallel here. You know, in the 1920s and 30s, before the vast numbers of people traveled in planes without thinking about it, you know, commercial travel was fairly risky. The death rate was hundreds of times higher than it is now. It was very expensive. Only very rich people did it. That really sounds like space travel now. But obviously, over the decades, the safety features improved. The technology's improved, and now, you know, billions, tens of billions of passenger miles are flown every year, and people don't think twice about it. It's not really the same thing. I mean, that making that analogy, you could push it a little too far. You're still sitting on a barely contained explosion, which is not the case in a commercial jet. And space is an extremely inhospitable environment. So it's never going to be as cheap or as easy or as safe as commercial flights, But it will go in that direction, I think, as they learn. I mean, Elon Musk's philosophy is to, you know, go learn fast and break things. And for all the bravado and so on, he's been very successful. His Falcon 9 workhorse rocket has had heading for 300 launches with only a handful of failures. That's a pretty good success rate in space, which where the historically the failure rate has been quite significant.
It'll be interesting, too, to see, you know, we have the FAA overseeing, you know, flights with the commercial airlines and so forth. Who's going to govern? What government is going to oversee space flight?
Right. Well, you hit it. It is modeled on the FAA. So going back to the 1980s, successive administrations have taken a very light hand on the rudder as far as regulating the space industry because they didn't want to suppress the entrepreneurial activity before it really got going. So with that philosophy is what's fostered the current growth that we see now. So it's governed by an extension of the FAA type regulatory authority. Now that's within the United States. The bigger question, which has an interesting answer, is who's governing the space activity overall globally? The answer is no one. There's essentially no space law, I think I said in my talk. It's a wild west out there, and it really is. There's hardly any space law. There are two UN treaties, both going back decades, that deal with space. Nothing really deals with the ownership issue at all, because we only ever talked about governments and whether, you know, the US could declare the moon their property or Russia could right. declare Mars their property. So there's not a lot of regulatory oversight for the global activity.
Great. We're talking with Dr. Chris Impey from the astronomy department at the University of Arizona. One question that I'm kind of a nerd when it comes to astronomy. I like the coolness of it and so forth. But many people like me are overwhelmed with the vastness of space. And one thing that I think is interesting when we talk about space travel of leaving Earth and heading out towards something, when all those things are moving away from us, with that rapid expansion of the universe, as a physicist, how do you kind of wrap your head around that things are moving away from each other so fast?
Right. It is a strange concept. And basically, it's only understood in terms of Einstein's theory of gravity, general relativity. So we tend to think of the Big Bang. Well, it sounds like an explosion, doesn't it? But it's not really. It's space-time itself, the fabric of space, if you like, which is invisible, is expanding, and then the things within it, the galaxies, are just being carried apart in three dimensions. So that's the concept of expanding space. Now, the space we're dealing with space travel, is a tiny little backyard in our galaxy, and our galaxy isn't expanding, and the solar system isn't expanding.
Right.
So we're really just playing in very small scales of space compared to the vastness of the universe.
So space travel, then, if we get off Earth, we're not going to be going that far. We can't, I mean, it takes 7 years to get to Jupiter or Saturn or whatever. It takes a long time to get to these planets that are in our own solar system. So going too far is not really in the cards for most humans, right?
And not really for a while. I mean, so for all the successes of the recent commercial space flights, the reusability of the rockets, we're still using chemical energy. So, you know, Elon Musk's biggest rocket is Starship, is a big skyscraper-sized rocket, but it's really a cousin, just a remote cousin of the tiny little liquid rocket that Robert Goddard first flew in 1928, 100 years ago. It's the same chemical fuel, and chemical fuel is really inefficient. So unfortunately, you know, for people, the visionaries who really would like us to spread our wings beyond the solar system, that just isn't going to happen with chemical fuel. So we're going to have to develop fusion or fission power or some other form of power that we simply haven't even tested very well to ever get, as you point out, you know, it's a decade or so to get well out in the solar system. And that's just with space probes. That's not with people. We're still taking baby steps.
Right. When we come back after the break, we'll talk a little bit more about the vastness of space and talk a little bit more about your presentation at the Desert Oasis TEDx event, Our Future Off Earth. And I have a few questions for you that are just, me as an astronomy junkie that I just want to hear from one of the foremost thinkers in astronomy, Dr. Chris Impey. We'll be back in just a moment after a word from our great sponsors. You are listening to Jump in Tucson on KVOI 1030 AM, The Voice. This is the Wonder Series where we talk about wonderful things happening at the University of Arizona. We'll be back right after the break. Jump in Tucson. This is Dr. Ed Ackerley, and we're talking with Chris Impey, Dr. Chris Impey, the University of Arizona Distinguished Professor of Astronomy in the College of Science. Welcome back, Dr. Impey.
Good to be with you again.
Yeah, so you gave a presentation at the U of A called Our Future Off Earth and a visionary approach to looking at where are we going to be. So I have a couple of questions I've been dying to ask you over the years. You probably get these ringers every once in a while. Is there an edge to space? What do astronomers think about what beyond what we can see? Is there an edge? Does it stop or does it go on for infinity?
I mean, the simple and honest answer is we don't know. There doesn't have to be an edge in space in the theory of our universe and the Big Bang. There's not necessarily a boundary to the universe. So what there is there's a limit to how far we can see, because light doesn't travel infinite speed. It has a finite travel time. And the universe has a finite age. And you put those two together, and there's a distance out to which you can see. And it's the distance where light reached you in the 13.8 billion year history of the universe. So that's our operational edge of space. But that's not the end of it. You don't fall off anything. And of course, if you wait a year, you can see a light year further. And you wait 10 years, you see 10 light years further. So in a sense, if we just get patient, we'll see more and more of the universe.
Right, right. So to me, it's mind-boggling that that space is so vast. And you just, you know, for me, I can't wrap my mind around it really. And I know that it's thinkers like you, visionaries and so forth. You know, for me, it's incomprehensible the distances of the objects in space and the difference, even in our own solar system, how far away the other planets are and how far we are away from the sun. And these are massive objects with gigantic solid rock planets and gas planets and brilliant stars from our galaxy. They're dwarfing everything we know. Pulsars from way out there at the edge of that universe that we just talked about. How do you wrap your mind around these fundamentals of space and communicate this vastness to the audiences that you talk with?
Sure. I mean, astronomers get a little blasé about it because we work with the numbers. But understanding the numbers doesn't sort of help you appreciate it like in your gut intuitively. So I use scale models, and I like to think of the scale models to tether this. And since we've been talking about space travel, a good way to start is, you know, just imagine how far humans have got, not spacecraft, but humans. So you make the Earth a golf ball and the moon is a pea, it's at arm's length on a scale model. And that's as far as humans have got, you know, in the scale model. And we, you know, 24 people went to the moon, 10, 12 walked on it, and that's it. And on that scale, the sun is a 3-meter globe 100 meters away, and the nearest and the outer edge of the solar system is like 10 miles away. So, you know, there we've gone that sort of 1 yard, 1 meter, and you got to go 10 miles to get to the edge of the solar system. So that's the sense of the solar system. And the nearest star in that same scale model is 50,000 miles away. So, you know, it's an insane ratio. The distance to the stars is hundreds of thousands to millions of times further than the distance to the furthest planet. And that's just the nearest stars. So even one scale model like that just doesn't let you encompass the universe. You'd have to shrink everything by some another large factor to get a different scale model. And so you can't get it all in view even with one scale model. But that's a start at least.
Right, right. And even that is just mind-boggling that 50,000 miles away is the nearest star in that model. It's just still just crazy, absolutely crazy. So, you know, the U of A has been on every NASA program since its inception and is a leader in space exploration and technology and astrophysics and astronomy. What's it like working every day at an institution like the University of Arizona, which has this long academic and scientific history in astronomy?
Oh, well, it's amazing. I mean, the history is so great. And I came here as a young faculty member because we were starting to build the 6 and 8 meter telescopes. And now we want to build, you know, our GMT 22 meter telescope. And the mirrors are churning out of the mirror lab, and the space telescopes are being built with instruments designed and architected by the Rikis and so on. So every year, every few years, there's some new innovative project. So U of A faculty are really, you know, at the heart of innovation in astronomy. Also, the astronomy department has a long history. I mean, it's from its foundation just over a century ago. The astronomy department sort of spun off physics, it spun off optical sciences, it spun off lunar and planetary lab, it spun off the tree ring lab. So astronomy has been the sort of origination point for at least five other departments at the University of Arizona.
It's a great, great place to do some research. And we're talking with Dr. Chris Impey from the College of Science, a world-renowned astronomer, with his recent presentation, Our Future Off Earth, as human beings as we move out into space. What is on the horizon for your own individual research and your interest in space exploration? What exciting new things do you think will be coming in the next 100 years?
Well, I mean, I still keep my hand into cosmology, the study of distant galaxies, which has been my research for decades, although I'm more heavily involved in education now. So I do hope, when I retire, to use our large new telescope, the GMT, down in Chile, currently under construction and still needing some extra funding and a few more partners, I think, to take it over the top. So I certainly hope to use the biggest telescopes available, including ours. And then also, you know, space telescopes, the James Webb. It's very hard to get time. It's the most competitive facility almost in science. Only one in 12 or one in 14 proposals get selected. You know, I hope to see us solve some of the big outstanding problems in the field. We still don't know what the universe is made of. We don't know what dark energy is, what dark matter is. There are little suspicions that the Big Bang model needs some serious repair, or is not, you know, it's not fundamentally flawed, but it may not be the final answer. So it's kind of interesting to be in a field that's moving so rapidly and has such great tools and facilities, and yet where there are profound questions that we haven't yet answered. That sort of makes it exciting, actually.
So part of what you do is to think, and to think into the future, and use physics and other things to help you understand these things. And people have been doing that for hundreds of years, thousands of years. How will AI affect astronomy in the future? Will that be a technological boost to being able to maybe do things faster, quicker, stronger, better? Or are we still going to be relying on the human brain to be thinking into the future?
No, AI it's a good question, because AI is so important for astronomy. I mean, it's affecting every scientific field. But actually, astronomers were using machine learning and AI methods 40 years ago, you know, before it became a hot topic
right.
in the world. You know, astronomy is a data intensive subject, big data. We take images of the sky that have terabytes, 10, 20, 30 terabytes a night, and it's just hard to process all that data. And so use AI methods, machine learning, and so on, to filter the data and to sift down that huge number of pixels, most of which are just dark sky or noise, to the very important things you want to measure, or to discover new things. AI is turning out to be quite good at discovering things you didn't anticipate. You know, it's not worth overselling AI. There's plenty
right.
of out there. There's a lot of overselling of AI, but really for science in general and astronomy, it's a very important tool. The people who hunt planets are using it to detect planets more efficiently, or interesting exoplanets, and in cosmology to define exotic galaxies at the edge of the universe. So it pretty much touches every field of astronomy.
Well, you have just been a gift for me over the years. I've just been following you and just love to think about the vastness of space and the human condition and where we are. So thank you for joining us today on Jump in Tucson. Dr. Chris Impey from the Astronomy Department at the College of Science at the University of Arizona. And you're in Oaxaca, Mexico right now. We got to get you back to your to your research down there.
Yeah, I'm just very much enjoying the Day of the Dead here. It's an enormous celebration in Mexico, of course, as you know, and in Oaxaca, it's a very traditional celebration. It's not just for tourists. It's what the people here do, parades, you know, festivities. It's pretty amazing to be down
right.
here.
Well, thank you for providing wonder at the University of Arizona. Jump in Tucson broadcast from Bustos Media. Thank you for listening, and we hope that you will jump in Tucson.